And I am going to suggest that maybe here in the American Public Health Association we have a model or some lessons to think about from what the Lancet's been up to. So you've undoubtedly all read a paper or two in the Lancet over the years and know what an incredibly prestigious journal it is, and it's using their power in a really interesting way. I was going to do a Prezi, but it turns out they charge you $500 to get internet access in a room here. Okay, so no Prezi. So I moved from Prezi to PowerPoint this morning in 20 minutes, so let's hope it all worked out. So The Lancet, interesting journal. When Thomas Wakeley founded The Lancet in 1823, that was a long time ago, he announced, "A lancet can be an arched window to let in the light, or it can be a sharp surgical instrument to cut out the dross, and I intend to use it in both senses." And apparently that philosophy remains. That saying is still on their website, and that remains their mission. The journal has an impact factor of greater than 39. The typical journal is 1.4, really lucky 3, you know, so an impact factor of 39 makes it an extremely prestigious journal, and it currently is ranked second out of 150 medical journals. So it has a lot of clout. And its editor is Richard Horton, who is a very interesting character. If you have not had an opportunity to hear him speak, you should seek one out. He has been with that journal since 1990, just 4 years after he graduated from medical school. I don't think he started there as the editor, but he is now. And he has suffered through many controversies at The Lancet, including in 2004 when he published Les Roberts' paper on counting casualties in Iraq associated with the U.S. invasion. And that was a very risky thing for him to have done and nearly led to his expulsion from the journal. So when Richard Horton launched the Palestinian Health Alliance at The Lancet, he said, "Our ultimate hope is that this series could contribute to a mass international social movement for peace and justice through health in and with the people of the occupied Palestinian land. Justice in this context is about fashioning a fair and sustainable future for the people of Palestine. Health can be a magnetic nucleus to draw together the necessary critical mass of agreement to make this idea more than simply an aspiration." So that was in 2009. They launched the Health Alliance series with 7 commentaries and 5 research papers. And since then, they have held several scientific conferences and a writing workshop or two in order to spur especially Palestinian researchers to participate in this. I looked through the 105 papers that have been published through the Alliance series and just did my own little tally of what the topics were that have been described. And the favorite topic is a variety of diseases. I'm not a big fan of diseases. So I'm sure those of you who care about specific diseases like diabetes and coronary disease and that sort of thing will find details in there about specific diseases that you might care about. So those are the predominant area, and the color code is by year, so the most recent year is on top, so you can see diseases are a big deal. Next is on health systems and research and teaching, lot on that, and next is perinatal things about birthing and prenatal and infant neonatal things. Response to political events is a topic that gets some discussion. And then there have been a handful on food and malnutrition, environmental threats, mental health, and humiliation as a topic, as a subcategory of mental health, which is, I think, a really important determinant of health that we don't talk about in war settings nearly enough. So the conferences are another big component of the Lancet's effort. Its first conference was in Birzeit University in the West Bank. They held a writer's workshop in 2011, and then since then there have been annual conferences. Has anyone here been to one of these conferences? Yeah, okay, so maybe you can tell us a little about that during the Q&A. And it's a, you know, conferences, as we know, as we are sitting here, can be an important way to bring people together around an issue and raise visibility and commentary. And I suggest that for our own American Journal of Public Health, which is published by APHA, there might be an opportunity around this. Our beloved editor, Mary Northridge, retired from that job in September of this year. And as she was leaving, she had this very nice essay in the journal about the social justice agenda and APHA and AJPH's role in promoting that. So I think we're well positioned to do that sort of thing within our own organization. Before we leave the Lancet, though, I think it's important to point out that there was the whole little controversy this summer when Israel invaded Palestine again. And some health workers wrote to the Lancet with this open letter for the people in Gaza, which the Lancet published. Let me just read you a paragraph from this letter by Manduka et al. They said, "We are appalled by the military onslaught on civilians in Gaza under the guise of punishing terrorists. This is the third large-scale military assault on Gaza since 2008. This action also terrifies those who are not directly hit and wounds the soul, mind, and resilience of the young generation. Our condemnation and disgust are further compounded by the denial and prohibition for Gaza to receive external help and supplies to alleviate the dire circumstances. The blockade on Gaza has tightened further since last year, and this has worsened the toll on Gaza's population. In Gaza, people suffer from hunger, thirst, pollution, shortage of medicines, electricity, and any means to get an income, not only by being bombed and shelled. Power crisis, gasoline shortage, water and food scarcity, sewage outflow, and even decreasing resources and ever-decreasing resources are disasters caused directly and indirectly by the siege." And there was a large backlash to the Lancet about having published this letter. Many people, of course, trotted out the anti-Semitic label, since that's a very powerful tool to use. Big controversy back and forth. Again, Richard Horton having to defend his editorial decisions. In October of this year, the Lancet Ombudsman published in the Lancet this statement wherein he reviewed the original letter, all the response letters, the facts of the situation, and came to this conclusion. "There can be no doubt that wars and other serious conflicts and their grave consequences for health are appropriate subjects for discussion in medical journals. Medical journals' independent standpoints can help to shape innovative medical and political solutions to the problems involved and incurred in conflicts," and concluded that the calls for retraction of Manduka and co-author's letter are not persuasive. I think Richard Horton's longstanding position at the Lancet certainly helps him survive these controversies from time to time. And the Lancet attends to its bread and butter issues of having to really address the hard biomedical issues that they do in their journal. And I think that's a lesson for all of us, to have the power to have these political viewpoints and make these statements on the side. We have to do our regular book of business in a really strong and convincing and competent way, and they do that. A number of us contributed letters to the Lancet in that series, including Nancy and I and a colleague of ours, Cindy Sousa, and others signed on to that. So APHA has a continuing Palestinian Health Committee, which is a joint effort of the International Health Section, the Medical Care, and the Peace Caucus. We attempted to pass a resolution in APHA last year in defense of Palestinian health, which suffered a rather dramatic defeat in the Governing Council. And so this year, our initiative is to try to persuade the organization to deepen our understanding on this issue by sponsoring a study tour to the region. So we are in hopes that our executive director, Georges Benjamin, may organize such a tour. He is convening a meeting this afternoon that may start to launch some work on that. And all of us can continue to conduct research and attend conferences and publish in this area. It's the strength we have, and we need to apply it to this important area. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. I'd like all the panelists to sit at the front here. So are you there? Could you come to the front so you can answer questions from people and they can see you and direct them to you? Okay, so we're open for discussion, questions. I think we have 5 seats here, but be prepared to stand up, folks. Anyone? In the back of the room, a little bit to the right, number 1, and number 2, the guy with the plaid shirt. Speak really loudly, please. We have a list of sessions and events relating to Palestinian health, and on the bottom is a contact email, and basically that's my email. My name is Nancy Stoller, and you can track me down pretty easily, I think. But we also have these.
Is it in the back?
What? On the bottom of each page. The gentleman here. And you'll be next. Speak loudly, please.
Sure. So my name is Stuart Gabriel. I'm a professor at UCLA. And just wanted to congratulate the presenters. Very, very interesting talks and very appreciative. I was hoping I could say a word or two or ask a question or two about a couple of the papers. First paper I wanted to just mention was your schema. And very much appreciate your focus on the issue of Palestinian health. My concern here, however, is methodological. And while I haven't read your paper, I only saw your presentation today. What I saw was the presentation of raw health disparities in the form of summary statistics. And that concerned me because, as we all know, as public health researchers, there are many socioeconomic, geographic, longitudinal, and other determinants of those health statistics that you presented. And one would expect a rigorous sort of presentation of the topic, a presentation that could develop data and even, you know, hypothesis testing.
Could you come to the point of your question? Because we don't have too much time. Could you come to the point of your question,
yeah,
please?
Okay. So my question is, could we talk afterwards about bringing data and hypothesis testing and sort of rigorous methodology to your paper? And Steve, you know,
why don't we just...
let's have freedom of speech here.
We do have freedom of speech, but the point of this is for people to be able to ask questions
okay.
So and not
so,
make
so
long comments here. Okay, I think you've made your point. We'd like to hear from the speakers. Would you like to speak?
Yeah, I think I can.
Whoever would? Fine.
I'll respond.
I don't know.
Okay, I'm not surprised by your comment, but I'm not going to
answer it with like a 30-minute discussion, but my short response is that, first of all, there isn't much data available longitudinally, especially about Palestinian health outcomes. And there's reasons for that. But if you go to Israel, there is data available. So that just that information alone, so I don't have the data. And if I did, I would be the first one to analyze it and to illustrate using hypothesis testing why and what are the disparities between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Okay, sorry, we're going to hear from the other panelist. Did you want to speak?
A quick comment. Yeah, I appreciate your comment. I don't think walls have ever solved the problem. They don't address the root causes of what's going on, either in the U.S.-Mexican issue or the Palestinian-Israeli issue.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. I think there was somebody over here. One, two.
Yeah, I was just wondering in terms of the...
Please speak loudly.
Yeah, the U.S. and nation bombing campaigns against ISIL in Syria, how is that impacting the conditions and the challenges that you described in your report?
Thank you. I think certainly the jury's still out. I think we've seen, as we're collecting information, we're learning more about what the actual impact is. Short term, there's a number of impacts. First is a huge shift of focus away from the humanitarian and the political resolution of the crisis in Syria. Medium term, there is certainly in the midst of that bombing, although there's efforts, we're told, to minimize damage to civilian infrastructure. There has been damage to civilian infrastructure. And then long term, I think there's a real question about what's going to be the impact, and I think that's still up to see what's going to happen. There have been reported civilian casualties as a result of the bombing from a number of different independent sources. They don't seem to be very much outside of... They don't seem to be massive. They do seem to have the majority of those killed in the bombing seem to have been identified as militants. But then again, that's information largely coming from the U.S., so it's really uncertain. I think we are concerned, though, that not only does the bombing campaign and this new focus distract from the cause of finding a political solution for the crisis, it also is an investment of a huge amount of money that could also be going to other areas, particularly the humanitarian response. And there is not a lot of information about the extent to which efforts are being made by the U.S. military and other militaries to limit civilian casualties as well as damage to civilian infrastructure. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question here, and then one and two.
So my question,
speak really loudly, please. Okay, thank you. First, Dr. Gilbert.
Short answer is no. We haven't done any research in the area. We focused a little bit on use of leaded gasoline, which is imported from Egypt. and contamination of kids. We all know that there is no safe level of lead exposure, as well as looking at the recycling of leaded batteries, and they contaminated a wide area around that, but have not looked at any of the weapons that are used, which I think that's a great area of research.
Report.
Great question about vouchers, and also happy to talk afterwards if you'd be interested. Very serious concern, you're absolutely right. One of the reasons that we work with vouchers is because it seems to have lower incidence of abuse as compared to other types of assistance distribution. You often see a lot of concerns, though, in all humanitarian operations, unfortunately. Anytime there's a power imbalance, there's opportunities for exploitation. So I glanced over it in my presentation, but the protection team that I listed as one of the sectors in which we work does go around. In addition to the safeguards that are built into the program itself and the different community organizations we work with, the protection team interviews refugees and recipients of assistance separately and finds out about these different concerns and helps set up referral mechanisms, reporting of any concerns. One of the really common things that happens is that people who get a $25 voucher will sell it for cash at a lower value in order to buy things which aren't covered in the voucher, like cigarettes, like alcohol. And increasing in alcohol dependency is another phenomenon which we're also noting. But people are often benefiting from this. They're sort of, you know, they're paying what amounts to $15 or $10 for a $25 voucher because people want that cash. So there's problems in that. That's also why we've done other work that's actually just giving people cash, which allows people to make their own decisions. There's a use of ATM cards where people who have access, because Lebanon is, again, a middle-income country, there's less opportunity for exploitation with cash. But again, it's still an ongoing problem. It's one that we monitor very carefully and take very seriously. But again, happy to talk afterwards if you'd be interested. Thanks.
There's a lot packed into your question about boycott, divestment, sanctions, academic boycotts. That's a huge topic under the umbrella of academic activities in this area. And I think, let me just say, you know, especially over this summer with the new controversy with Dr. Saleta at University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, that could be a whole session unto its own, and we are going to have opportunities for more of that conversation. Let me just say that the people who do this sort of academic work typically are doing this on the side. There are no NIH grants to do work in Palestine or to collect toxicity information about the wall or collect data about Palestinians or even to make trips there. This is all done by academic volunteers whose soft money funding support is being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed as public health support diminishes. So this is sort of a voluntary activity, and we ought to appreciate it.
I just like to add something about the topic of the academic boycott. For those of you who are unaware, the ideas behind the Boycott National Committee recommendations about boycott and divestment in regard to the academic boycott is to say that individuals who are doing research are not discouraged from traveling and doing research. This is not a boycott directed at individual researchers. This is a boycott which is about participating in Israeli state-funded research and Israeli state-funded universities in such a way that you legitimize the complicity of certain universities in the occupation. In other words, it does not prevent anyone from going to Israel, the West Bank, or Gaza to do research. It does not prevent any researcher from any university in Israel, the West Bank, or Gaza from coming to the U.S. to present their work. The coalition work that our first speaker spoke about is not something that would be criticized by the people involved in this boycott. if anyone has a question or concern, the basic principle here is if you want to work cooperatively with people in Israel on a project which supports the rights of Palestinians as well as Israelis to a full and healthy life, no one is going to criticize you. In addition, there are no sanctions, you know, that are applied against academics who go back and forth between these universities. So it's not like you're going to get your get held up at a border because you decide that you want to go to Haifa University or you want to do something with, another university, Tel Aviv University, et cetera. Okay, thanks. And the next person who had a question. And there and there.
I want to apologize because it's more a comment than a question. I've made several both medical and political trips to the West Bank and Israel, and the last one was in September. And I mean, I agree with everything all of you have to say about the horrendous health statistics, but I think the problem is when you talk about trying to improve health and healthcare in Palestine, what's currently going on, and isn't really different though, but what's going on so blatantly is that Israel is just really trying to take over the whole place and completely either kill people or make their lives so miserable that they will leave or disappear or die young, and that's the tactic. And it was interesting to me that on this trip, every Palestinian that I met, be it in the West Bank or in Israel, agreed. Everybody was talking about forget the two states, it's a myth. And, you know, what I found the problem was they're not really talking about what kind of state or how to build a movement to get there. But they certainly don't believe that a viable Palestinian state was ever meant to be by Israel or is possible or will ever happen. So I think we devolve to the question that the whole thing is completely political, and it's useful to do these exposés. I've done many of them myself about how horrendous the situation is, but to think we're improving it by sort of strengthening institutions in the West Bank, I think it's not going to happen. And I think the question is what kind of society and state should they be fighting for, which unfortunately in Palestine, from my limited survey and exposure there is, and one conference I went to on the issue in Ramallah, they're not really addressing it, unfortunately.
Next question.
Yes, Janice Camp, University of Washington. And I was really pleased that Oxfam was thinking about war economies. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what in particular Oxfam is doing to try to understand, intervene in, or mitigate the fact that people make a lot of money on war, and that oftentimes is what perpetuates them.
Thanks very much. Also happy to talk afterwards as well, so we can make sure we have enough questions. I think one of the really key pieces of work that we're involved with right now is looking at the war economy within Syria and how there are growing incentives for continuation of conflict by really a whole host of actors. There's a report that's just come out with some support from Oxfam by a Syrian organization called Medani, which is about the phenomenon of local ceasefires, and one of the key recommendations is how the war economy, basically analyzing and interrupting the war economy. I can give you the link to that report. But it's absolutely true that as this conflict just continues on, and I think no one thinks it's going to take less than years, if not decades, before it ends and is resolved in some way, there's this incredible entrenchment of the war economy. It's something that we've seen particularly in our work in Somalia, a lot of the protracted conflicts we work in, and finding ways to sort of remove those disincentives. In the case of Somalia, it was really working a lot with the business community. The business community had a huge interest in war continuing, which seems kind of funny, given that businesses often want a stable environment in which to work. But in a context in Somalia, again, where they're there wasn't taxation, where there was not services being provided by the government, it meant that there was a huge gap that the business was able to fill, working with those governments, to try to identify alternatives and what types of business interests they could pursue in the context of a peaceful solution and governing authority was, I think, really important. And it wasn't our work in particular, it was the work of a lot of really strong Somali organizations. And I think, again, in the case of Syria, it's really going to be led by Syrian organizations to the extent that they are able to analyze the local conditions in the war economy in the very local, at the very local level, because they really vary between warlords and all different kinds of people, different actors who are emerging as a result of this conflict.
Thank you. I would like the panel to be prepared for this one last thing I'm going to ask of you. I want to remind people that this session is sponsored by the Peace Caucus and that APHA has committed itself through the passage of its policy statement on war and the prevention of war to this very idea, which is that war is unhealthy, it's damaging to the health of children and others, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, we're here in this meeting right now and in this session because we believe that war, militarism, military occupation are damaging and should be addressed at the roots. I want to remind people that when we had several speakers here talking about Palestinian health, $3 billion of our tax money in 2014 has been spent on Israeli military expenses. And I just want to remind you that a lot of that money is actually spent in the U.S., where a lot of weapons and other parts of the equipment and the structure of the occupation take place. In other words, when Noah Gottschalk talks about, interfering with the war economy, we can interfere with the war economy here by addressing the involvement of the U.S. in the war economy, whether it's in Syria or in other countries around the world. The last thing I want before we go, it's almost noon, is if there's any last comment by any of the panelists. Just we'll go along the line, anything you want to say. Okay, thank you very much for coming, and thanks to our panel. Please talk to them.